This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Record numbers of women are running for public office this year. They're looking at all kinds of positions, from state legislators to governors to members of Congress. And whether or not they'll be elected remains to be seen, but their attempts could counteract some staggering statistics. For every one woman who is a governor or a member of Congress or a state legislator in this country today, there are three men. That's according to an analysis from the Washington Post. Well, a collection of oral histories from the Southern Oral History Program highlights some of the women who have paved the way in North Carolina. Joining me now is Rachel Seidman. She's a professor of history and women's and gender study at UNC Chapel Hill and the director of the Southern Oral History Program. Rachel, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Margaret Henderson, a lecturer at the UNC School of Government and part of a team that works on an initiative to engage women in public service. Hello, Margaret.
Hi.
Rachel, talk to us a little bit about the Southern Oral History Program. How did it get started, and what are you doing with it now?
The program, which is based now in the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina, has been around since the early 1970s. We've been collecting oral histories with people all across the South, which we record and transcribe and put in the archives. And these are remarkable stories of people's lives, everyone from famous politicians that you might have heard of to mostly people whose lives are unknown, whose stories would never be included in the history textbooks, but whose voices we have saved for posterity. We have close to 6,000 of these interviews now. They're remarkably diverse in terms of race and age and gender and sexuality. And they are housed in the Wilson Library. But they are made digitally available to anyone in the world. You can listen to them. You can read the transcripts. One of the things that we've been really focusing on, though, is that it's one thing to have this amazing treasure trove of stories, but we really want lots of people to know that they're there and to make use of them. So we've really been trying to think about new audiences. How can we reach out to people who we think would benefit from them? So we've identified some audiences that we're trying to reach out to. One of the first ones that we started focusing on were K-12 teachers, because we know the power of these stories. We know that kids often think that history happened long ago and far away to people not like them, but that listening to people's voices can really change that, and that teachers would be able to use clips from our interviews to enliven their classrooms. So we've been reaching out to K-12 teachers, building lesson plans for them, working with teachers to build those lesson plans, creating a new digital map that is a map of North Carolina embedded with people's stories from across the state.
Yeah, I think creating those curricula is an important part of this, because I'm sure teachers would love to have access to all that stuff. They don't have time. So the fact that you're working with them to create the curricula, package it, and put it in their hands is pretty fascinating stuff. Well, another group who found this fascinating, Margaret, was yours. You reached out to Rachel and the project and this program to get some interviews for a conference that you were organizing this summer. Am I right?
That's right. On June 8th, we'll have our fourth conference for engaging women in public service. It's called Building Your Leadership Muscle. And so I went to talk with Rachel, and it was purely exploratory. I had no idea what the outcome would be, but it's going to be great. They've captured these voices for us of all these women in public leadership in North Carolina from a number of different decades, and are presenting that to us in such a way that our participants are going to be able to hear them that day or whenever they need to. And then I hope, too, that our participants will now see this project, the Oral History Project, as a resource they can tap in their communities.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the nice things about digitizing it, I would think. It makes it a lot easier to slice and dice. So when a group with a particular agenda or activism comes to you, you can say, yeah, I think we can find those voices for you.
Yes, absolutely.
What were you looking for, Margaret, and what was it that's going to be helpful for you when you think about the particular conference you had in mind? What was your hope? What did you want to find?
Well, the intention of our conference is to encourage women to step up their game in terms of public leadership, whether that's in elected or appointed positions. And for women, one of the initial obstacles is getting out of their own way. And by that, I mean women have to put themselves out there to take these leadership positions, whether they're city or county managers or sit on boards of county commissioners or run for state office or whatever that is. And so what I had hoped is that some of these clips would convey how other women have addressed that, how they struggled with it, how they got past the point of assuming somebody else would take up the banner. But no, they decided they needed to do it themselves.
Pretty well illustrated in the first clip that we want to play here. And this is a clip from Isabella Cannon. It was recorded in 1989, but well before that, about a decade before, I think. She was the first woman to be elected mayor of Raleigh, North Carolina. Here she is.
I was not part of the good old boy network, and we'd get to a council meeting and they'd go off for lunch or they'd go off to a meeting and I would be alone. I look at the fact that I am the only woman mayor of Raleigh in almost 200 years of history. Unless a woman declares this year, and we'll go on to the 200, as being the only woman who has ever offered herself. You see, it's not just that the citizenry can elect a woman has to offer herself. Now, it never occurred to me as anything historic when I did it. I was just a furious, angry citizen, and I wanted to see something done. I was not running as a female or as an older citizen. I was just running as somebody mad about what was happening, and I felt like I could do something about it. So women have got to take more leadership roles. Women need to have more confidence in themselves. Be longer in the pipeline, be longer in the business community, be more active in the political community.
That's Isabella Cannon, who in 1977 was elected as the first woman to be elected mayor of Raleigh, North Carolina. Nancy McFarland, now the mayor. And of course, since then, another woman has been elected. The interview was done in 1989, and it's archived in the Southern Oral History Program, housed at the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm talking to the program's director, Rachel Seidman, and Margaret Henderson, who is a lecturer at the School of Government and who works to engage more women in public service. So there it is. Let me ask you, Rachel, this idea that women, you know, bear some of the responsibility. We have to put ourselves forward. Talk more about that and how we're seeing that play out today.
Well, studies of women's leadership have shown that in general, women need to be tapped multiple times. Someone needs to tap them on the shoulder and say, you would be really good at this. You should run. And they have traditionally been more resistant to the idea of just sort of stepping forward and saying, I'm going to run for that office. And Cannon's a wonderful example of somebody who did that. And also, I think a really interesting example, you know, no one tapped her. She got mad. And one of the things that we're seeing today, you were talking about the surge, is that a lot of women are not waiting anymore to be tapped. They just got really mad and now they're running for office. So I think her interview is a great foreshadowing of what can happen when women get mad.
Well, Margaret, is it just that? Because obviously that's what happened in this case. Perhaps what's behind at least some of what we're seeing in 2018. But your job, at least for this conference, is to think about ways for women to become more engaged. Are there structural barriers? Are there other ways in which women are and somehow intimidated or feel there are obstacles to their or barriers to becoming engaged?
Well, I think if you talk to any woman who's in a position of public leadership, you can quickly come up with anecdotes about how they've been treated differently somehow. Whether it was the interview questions they were asked when applying for the position as manager, or I can recall one woman manager being up for a position and telling us that one of the commissioners wasn't going to vote for her, to be hired because, honey, there's a lot of meetings at night and I don't want you driving after dark. So those kinds of things are still there.
Yeah. Well, you have experience in your own family when your mother ran for the school board. Huh?
Well, my mother didn't run. It was a write-in vote. This was in the late 60s, early 70s, and a bunch of women had decided it was time to have a woman on the school board in my little farming community, and they started writing in her name. My dad told her she would never be elected. There'd never be a woman elected, but she was. So it was completely unintentional on her part, but she landed there.
Well, I want to listen to another clip, and maybe, Rachel, you can tell us a little bit about Annie Brown Kennedy before we play this clip.
Annie Brown Kennedy was the second black woman licensed to practice law in North Carolina. She got her license in 1954, and then she became the first to serve in the General Assembly. And in this clip, she's talking about some of the problems and barriers that still exist.
So often when you make a suggestion or complain about a wrong, then you end up being put on the committee. And so I've found that to be the case. I've been the first woman to be president of the Forsyth County Bar Association. And, of course, I think I was put on the track because I complained that all of the people in leadership positions were white males. I tell you, we've never been able to be totally comfortable because even though it would appear that some progress was being made, some doors were being opened, we knew that we had not totally arrived to full citizenship. Every step along the way, we as blacks or African Americans have had to remain conscious of the fact that we had to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. We're not yet full citizens in terms of our definition of what a full citizen is or should be.
That's a clip from an interview with Annie Brown Kennedy. It was recorded in 1995, and it's archived with the Southern Oral History Program, housed at the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm here with the program's director, Rachel Seidman, and Margaret Henderson. Margaret's a lecturer at the School of Government who works to engage more women in public service. And Rachel, I think this touches on the idea of intersectionality, the idea that there's multiple roles that can be played here.
Right. Intersectionality is a fancy word for the fact that people's lives are shaped by more than one identity, right? Women who are women of color or who are disabled or who come from a lower economic status will have different experiences than white women, for instance. So this is a clip where you see someone reflecting on how both her gender and her race shaped her experience in powerful ways. And a little bit later in that clip, in that interview, she talks about how every time they, African Americans, seem to be making some progress, then there's resistance and pushback. And that notion of backlash is one that Susan Faludi and others have also talked about in terms of women's progress, that as women make progress, start to gain power, then there's a backlash against it. And so this notion of progress and resistance always going hand in hand is one that women in leadership positions are fully aware of, that as they gain power, there are always people who resist that.
And Margaret, and what it takes to make real progress is another kind of interesting question. I mean, you talk about how many women need to be on the board or what percentage, some kind of critical mass, mm-hmm. so that sometimes we think progress is made when somebody breaks the barrier, but if they're still one of 15 members, it may not be effective. Talk more about that.
Well, there was a piece of research in which they were exploring what it takes for an organization to be successful, and they had five different indicators or so that they looked at, like productivity and how satisfied people were with the work and the innovation of the organization and so forth. And what they found out was that the more successful organizations got that way once they got past the gender balance of having at least 30% women involved in the organization. Now, the highest achieving organizations were more at 50% balance. I mean, true balance. Yeah. So we'd love to see that in our public boards, our public organizations, and reap the benefits of having that kind of truly democratic input.
Right, because you're not talking about the effectiveness of a movement, right,
no.
to promote women in high places. You're talking about the effectiveness of the organization.
Getting it's, the work
it works
done.
Better
yeah.
if you're closer to 50%. Well, I want to play yet another clip here. This one, Kim Pevia. She is a resident of Pembroke County, North Carolina, and she works to support Lumbee women.
It's interesting for me, especially as a Native American woman, there was a time when we were very matrilineally driven, and the clan system was based in the women. And then when Christianity hit us, we took on the patriarchy, and hasn't necessarily served us so well. Maybe not the best decision. I think women sometimes struggle to be their most powerful self. It throws us off balance when we try to lead the way that they do, but as we begin to ask for those things or insist for those things and vote for people who will make sure we get those things, that can all shift. But we're really just one generation away from really severe racism and just a couple of generations away from the women's movement where we got the right to vote. So I'm like, you know, while it seems like we want it to be a lot, and change happens slowly, you know, it really happens slowly. And so we all have to make our deposits in it and trust that it will keep going.
That's Kim Pevia, recorded in 2014, part of an interview archived at the Southern Oral History Program at the Center for the Study of the American South at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm here with the program's director, Rachel Seidman, and Margaret Henderson, a lecturer in the School of Government, who's working to engage more women in public service. What do we know about Native women's experience in public office, Rachel?
In public office? I'm not an expert on that, but I think that clearly what Kim is talking about is this notion of bringing your authentic self to whatever position of leadership that you're in. And she wants people to tap into what she sees as their own natural leadership style, the things that they care about, the issues that are important to them, and not try to fit into a mold that doesn't seem relevant to them or that might go against their own best interest. And so I think her words speak not just to Native American women, but to all women. And it's interesting because she is She's voicing an idea that is sometimes somewhat controversial, this notion that women and men have different leadership abilities or styles or approaches. And this has been a really fascinating debate among feminists for a very long time about should women of or people of any race or ethnicity be in public office, particularly women, because they are different from men, or should they be in and therefore we need their special insights, we need their special experiences, or should they be in public office because they are 50% of the population, they are equal to men, and that's why they should be represented. And Kim is asking people to really tap into a notion of feminine leadership or maybe authentic leadership, which is a both a very powerful and sometimes a complicated notion.
Complicated because it raises an important question. If you think part of the structure, the power structure itself, was designed to protect male privilege, let's say that's inherent in it, whether it's conscious or not, then there's something about that structure that would keep you, as she says, off balance if you bring your best authentic self to a structure that is meant to keep you from being in
Well, power. Right. And when we are taught about what is a leader, who is a leader, all of the images are usually masculine images. In fact, I remember a time when a poster went up on a campus, you know, saying that people should run for school of government or for not school, for the student government. But the image was of a headless body in a suit and tie. And that just sent a particular message about who student government leaders were.
Which is why we need to hear these voices more and more and more in order to get this complex story in its full throat. And I want to thank you for bringing it to us, Rachel Seidman, a professor at UNC Chapel Hill, director of the Southern Oral History Program. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Margaret Henderson, a lecturer at the UNC School of Government, part of a team that works on an initiative to engage women in public service. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Margaret's organizing a one-day event for women interested in public service featuring interviews from the program. It's on June 8th. It's in Winston-Salem, and the information's at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Sarah Shook and the Disarmers. Stay tuned.